is the diagnostic assessment model for RTI according to Kay. So I am not speaking on behalf of either of those organizations. So what I will be sharing with you today is the information that falls between what the other presentations in this webinar series have addressed. Dr. Hintz talked about screening, and he also talked about progress monitoring. And so what I'll be sharing with you today is the diagnostic piece that typically comes between screening and the progress monitoring that you would be doing. Okay, and in adding the RTI model and now with the Common Core, I think many new assessments have come into our classrooms. And the question that we need to ask at this point is how much is enough and how much is too much? So today, some of what I'll be addressing is what types of assessments should we be using? Can we use CBMs to inform instruction if we record errors and perform a formal miscue analysis on those errors? That's a question that people have often asked me because we want to really make the maximum use of the assessments that we are using, and how can are there ways that we can double dip so that we can make our assessment process more efficient? So that's a question that several people have asked me. Or the other question that I often receive is, would it be possible for us to use our running records as screening instruments and also for progress monitoring if we time the reading? So finding ways to use the assessments that we have in our schools in more efficient ways is something that we will be addressing today, and also how we might use diagnostic assessment to increase student performance on the ELA test and make sure that our diagnostic assessments are in alignment with the standards and the kinds of assessments that the children will be taking in the spring. So first, what we want to ask ourselves is, what is it that we want our assessments to do before we decide which assessments we want to use? So the tasks that we need assessments to do are, we want them to certainly measure the achievement of students, determine student particular and specific student needs, trace students' learning trajectory, and again, that progress monitoring piece that John Hintz talked about was specific to that and the best ways to do that. And then also, we want to make sure that our assessments that we have in place enable us to evaluate whether the instruction that we have is effective and is an effective model. So with RTI, we have some, particularly in RTI, the role of assessment has really become increasingly important because the assessments that we will be using now assume an increasingly important role in making long-term decisions for children. The goal of RTI, or one of the two main goals, is to really move away from that single snapshot determination for special education to more of a group process or a process that occurs over time rather than on a single day. So the assessments that we use are going to be an important element in that process. Screening measures are one indicator of children who may need additional support, and that's the preliminary way of beginning further assessments. Typically, children had to fail for a period of time before they would be eligible. So, for example, when we were using that IQ and achievement discrepancy model, typically that kind of discrepancy would not be able to be identified until about third grade. And so that meant that by the time children were identified for special ed, there were wide gaps in where they were and in their achievement that were very difficult to make up. Today, progress monitoring in all settings holds the promise of growth for all students, regardless of whether we are talking about a general classroom education setting or an intervention setting, or even in that special ed setting. We want to use our progress monitoring to make sure that all children are making progress over time. Now, this, John Hintz said in his last presentation, the psychological tests and CBMs are not really designed to diagnose specific needs. He actually compared it. He said it's like using apples and oranges. So what we really want to do is look at what kinds of diagnostic measures we can use to target specific learning needs that our children have. And one of the challenges with using CBMs to act as a diagnostic is because often the children who need the most help are not are performing at frustration levels on those CBMs. So, for example, on the oral reading fluency, children who are having difficulty and are in those red and yellow areas, if they're in second grade, they are typically not reading at a second grade level. So it's not really giving a true picture of their function. On the other hand, those one-minute assessment measures, those CBMs, really do ensure the sensitivity to identify change that occurs within a very short period of time. And so that is really one of the important values of using CBMs as a progress monitoring tool. But they are not specific enough typically to generate prescriptions for instruction. And so we'll talk in more detail today about the kinds of assessments that will enable you to do that. So the two categories of assessments that we're going to be talking about, okay, we have the two types of assessments are summative and formative. And each of those assessment types perform the following functions: screening, diagnostic, progress monitoring, and also evaluative. So summative assessments are generally a snapshot of a student at just one particular point in time. And normally those tests provide a standard that we will be able to compare a child's progress to a particular standard. Summative assessments usually occur after instruction, whether it's at the end of the year or possibly at the end of a unit or at the end of a particular amount of instruction. Summative assessments can not only be used to gauge where children are at a particular point in time, but they're also useful for evaluating the effectiveness of particular programs that we might be using or school goals and also school programs. So, for example, some of the schools in the state of New York may have used their New York State ELA test to really gauge whether their curriculum is in a close alignment with the new national standards. And so a summative assessment can be used in that kind of way and is very effective for evaluating a large umbrella program. So some additional examples of summative assessments would be your F&P. Some of you who use, say, an F&P benchmark kit, or and that would be the holistic level. So, for example, in September, is a child reading at a particular text level that we expect them to be reading at the beginning of, say, first grade or second grade? Unit and chapter tests, and also even an assessment like the Words Their Way or Gansky spelling inventory, those assessments can be used multiple ways. They can be used as a summative if you're simply looking at the power score, or they can be used formatively if you're looking at for the individual pieces of information that are available. Now, formative assessments provide the information needed to monitor and adjust instruction, and they can occur in a variety of formats. And the administration and scoring of formative assessments really occurs along a broad continuum, ranging from no standardization, such as in when you're doing questioning in a lesson, just asking children questions after you read a particular text is considered a formative assessment. And that would be considered an assessment that has practically no standardization of administration or scoring because it varies from based on the text. However, something like the Words Their Way feature analysis, which is also considered a formative assessment, but it has very rigorous procedures and clearly prescribed standardization of how you administer the test. It's also clearly prescribed how you score the test. And then, based on those scores, what do you do with those point values, and how do you use those point values to develop a particular sequence of instruction? And that is very prescribed, despite the fact that this is considered a formative assessment. And so formative assessments generally should inform both the teachers and also students about ongoing movement toward learning goals. So I know one of the easy ways that's a nice example that I know that we use in one of our books about assessment is that we say, for example, if you are the cook and you are preparing dinner, when you are tasting the recipe as you go along and are preparing the dinner, that's formative assessment. And then when you present it to your guests, that is summative assessment. Now, formative assessments typically have very high positive consequential validity. So what is consequential validity? Consequential validity enables you to answer the question, what is the consequence of this assessment process? And typically, formative assessments are known for having high positive consequences. So, for example, the very act of getting children to retell, and we do that, and we are listening to our children retell a story, for example, then that has high positive consequences, because then by the very nature of asking children to do it more frequently, they become better at it. And by the very nature of us knowing, for example, that children are going to have to answer a question, have to answer and do a retelling at the end of a benchmark assessment, that would force us to say, gee, I'd better ask these children to provide a retelling rather than just asking each child to provide a bit of a story instructionally. And I'm not going to just ask this child to provide the beginning and this child to provide the middle and this child to provide the end. I'm going to ask Susie to tell me the story from beginning to end, because I know that next week when I give her her benchmark assessment, she's going to have to, when I give her that running record and that assessment, she's going to have to retell the entire story. So that kind of instruction and assessment sequence is considered consequential validity. And formative assessment is usually, because it's so closely related to instruction, has high consequential validity. However, the opposite side of that coin is it can often be difficult for teachers to separate instruction from assessment. And that's the flip side of the coin. And that can be a challenge, a validity challenge with formative assessments, because we want to make sure that if we are using something for assessment that we're documenting, we do want to make sure, for example, if we're doing a running record for assessment purposes, not for teaching purposes, we want to make sure that we are not providing children with clues during that assessment process and during scaffolding. So we want to make sure that if we are using formative assessments, that we have a clear idea on what the boundaries are of the administration, of the standardization process of administering it. Most of the diagnostic assessments that we use are formative assessments. So, for example, things like that qualitative, the Words Their Way qualitative stage assessment, where we actually look at the features that the children have identified in the words that they've spelled. We're not just looking for a quantitative numerical score. We're actually looking at what errors they made and how many of those errors did they make? And what does that say about their knowledge of a particular spelling feature? Things such as anecdotal records, peer assessment, rubrics, and even our daily running records that we take are all examples of formative assessments, and particularly that MSV analysis, when we analyze the errors that children make so that we are identifying what strategies are children using to identify those unknown words. Those are all important formative assessments. Now the function, I think this was gone over fairly clearly in your, for those of you who attended the first two, or the first three sessions of the webinar series. The screening assessments these are the functions. Screening is one function that is given at the beginning of the year or intermittently throughout the year, typically three times, to identify children who may need additional help. The diagnostic assessment is what we'll use to really do an in-depth follow-up to identify particular areas that children may be encountering difficulty. And within those areas, what are their strengths? Where is the process breaking down? What are they ready to learn? And those results are what will inform our instruction and enable us to really find what I like to call that sweet spot of instruction that is going to enable us to have nice outcomes on our progress monitoring. Because without a clear target, that progress monitoring, when we monitor children's progress, without a clear target, we will not get the results that we're looking for on those general outcome measures. I think one of the things that is very important for schools to do in this era of so many assessment choices, it is really imperative that schools define through an audit process what assessments are being used at each grade level, and then distribute in a deliberate way who's going to be administering which assessments. And how will that information be communicated among us? And I think those ways that we communicate those outcomes needs to be done very meaningfully and clearly with a lot of transparency into each person that's involved in working with the child. So, we can't really expect any one of our teachers, be it any level, the teacher, be it tier one, tier two, tier three, to be responsible for all of the assessments or to be expert in the administration of all the assessments. So we really want to make sure that we at the school level have defined what cohesive set of assessments we're using to get a clear picture and a clear profile of each of our children, and then we want to identify in a very clear way who is doing what. And let me just say a word or two. We have our screening assessments that typically would be administered by our tier one teacher with perhaps some assistance from the tier two teacher before the intervention groups are assigned. Instructional diagnostics might be things like the Words Their Way test or the running records that a classroom teacher does to identify at a basic level the preliminary information she needs to instruct her students. Progress monitoring is typically going to be done mostly in tier two and tier three, but there will be some progress monitoring done in tier one. And what I call diagnostics number two, those are those really quite in-depth diagnostics that require specialized training and that typically only a literacy specialist, a school psychologist, or a special educator would have the expertise to administer. And also time is an element. These are also very timely. These these diagnostic level two are very timely, or very time consuming to administer. And so we really want to make sure that particularly those most intense and time-consuming diagnostics are only done with a handful of children that have the most needs. Okay, we've mentioned screening measures, and that was covered in your earlier webinar. So the diagnostic measures that might be used might be things like an extended IRI process or informal reading. When I say IRI, that's referring to an informal reading inventory process that engages children in reading text, doing a retelling, answering questions, and that reading, whether it be orally for younger children or silently for older children, would be timed to give us a nice word correct per minute or word per minute fluency score. And we want to do diagnostic measures. We don't want to forget about our national reading panel pillars. We want to use our diagnostic measures within each of the pillars, or we would also use what I'm going to talk about a little later, which is a model, a cognitive model that will also give us a model of determining when and where do we use each of these measures for phonics, fluency, and comprehension and vocabulary. The progress monitoring is a means of microscopically examining student achievement, and it traces those individual learning trajectories and evaluates the effectiveness of instruction. They are very sensitive so that you can really see some shifts, say, from week to week or, biweekly. And this focus of these progress monitoring measures is the achievement level and rate of progress. And so the diagnostics relate to these progress monitoring measures because we really want to target the particular area where our student is, provide an intervention in that area, so then when we progress monitor, we are able to see some growth, rather than just throwing out instruction haphazardly, blindly, like say, pin the tail on the donkey and just hoping that we've made a difference. We want to ensure through our diagnostic testing that we are teaching to a target, and then it will not be surprising to us when we do our progress monitoring that both that achievement level, is increasing, we're getting closer to our goal, and the rate of progress is a good rate as well, because we have narrowed that instruction to a target. Now, whenever my husband, my late husband, Stephen Stahl, or I have given professional developments to teachers, we have asked them, what are the three goals, or what goals do they have for their children? And inevitably, the three goals that teachers inevitably want are they want children to comprehend, to be able to learn from text that they're reading, also to be able to read fluently and to recognize automatically words automatically and effortlessly, and we also want children to be able to enjoy reading and be motivated. And so these things do not operate in a silo. You can't really comprehend text if you're not recognizing words automatically. Nor can you enjoy text if you're not comprehending it or if the reading is tedious. So these things really work together. They're not exclusive. So we approached, and particularly my husband, developed something called a cognitive model of reading, where we all recognize that the primary purpose of reading is to comprehend. And so the three pathways that he identified are automatic word recognition, language comprehension, and intentional strategies used in flexible ways specific to particular purposes for reading and particular texts. And this is what that cognitive model looks like. And we will be using this model, and in the reading clinic and with my students, I always do use this cognitive model for identifying children's strengths and weaknesses. And so we start with comprehension, and then we go to these three pathways, which are a little different than the pathways that perhaps are in the Common Core and on the Engage New York website. Some of the recommended, or not recommended, but some of the materials that are on the New York Engage website are the core knowledge, which takes a simple view of reading and really looks at this, you know, those are based on the simple view of reading, which is a combination of decoding and language comprehension. And that if basically Goff and Tumner, who developed the simple view of reading, said that if you put those two things together, you know, you have children who have good language comprehension and children who can decode. And if you put those two abilities together, then children will be able to comprehend. Well, we have said that in addition to automatic word recognition and language comprehension, we believe that you also need some strategic knowledge that is specific to text reading. And it even varies by the type of text that you're reading. Informational and narrative text, the strategic processes, some of them are shared, others are unique to particular types of informational text. And so each of these boxes, we actually have some assessments that we like to use diagnostically to identify strengths and weaknesses in each of these areas. So the assessments that I'm going to be talking about, and I will be referencing these two books. Okay, the Assessment for Reading Instruction is a book that has all of the diagnostic assessments that I'll be talking about today, and it has them all available in reproducible form. I mean, we don't hold the market on that. You can actually Google some of these assessments I'll be talking about and get them for free just simply by Googling them. But if you'd like to have like one place where you get all the books, we do all the assessments. We do have them in the first book, Assessment for Reading Instruction in reproducible format. Then we also have the reading assessment in an RTI framework. Michael McKenna has been my co-author on both of these books. And the second book actually talks a little more about the actual process of both the process of figuring out how to do this systemically in a school system, as well as how to teach the diagnostic process in Tier 2 and Tier 3. Now, I will say we're just going to go over this briefly today. I can't teach this in 30 minutes. I mean, my students take three courses on it over the course of three semesters. But we will be surveying these kinds of diagnostic processes and some things that you need to begin to keep in mind as you personally or as your school develops and make sure that this diagnostic process is in place as part of your larger assessment system. So let's talk about the automatic word recognition pathway. That pathway includes phonological awareness, decoding, sight word knowledge, and fluency as well. All right. And so you've talked already with Dr. Hintz about the screening, which includes for phonological awareness, would include initial sound, segmentation. But as teachers who are working with children, those children who come up on your screening in those yellow and red areas need a more detailed look, because particularly that segmentation is the most sophisticated skill, ability. And so therefore, you would want to investigate some of those same tasks that were identified by the National Reading Panel. For example, if a child can't do segmentation, then we really need to back up and think about, can they do rhyming? Can they identify rhymes that are teacher-generated? Can they identify rhymes that are student-generated? How about phonemic isolation? How about blending? Are they able to blend? Because that's quite a bit easier than segmentation. are they able to manipulate phonemes in other ways, such as by adding and deleting phonemes? And those are all the kinds of diagnostic assessments that you would want to engage your child with that is not successful in these two screenings. Another test that enables you to see that is an analysis of invented spelling, such as something like Marie Clay's dictation task, or the spelling, your spelling assessment that you've done, say with a kind of Words Their Way spelling inventory for young readers. And naturally, you want to be cautious using these with older students, because at that point, by the time you get to about second and third grade, research has found that spelling begins to confound these abilities of children to reflect these, because they will use some of the spellings that they have memorized or have learned logographically and will begin to apply those. So that requires a bit more care and caution and deliberation when we use these measures with older children. Decoding. As teachers, one of the biggest pieces of advice that I would give you is to really make sure that you are familiar at a very intimate level with the stages of decoding and spelling development. You really want to make sure that you know that in word recognition, the stages that children go through in a very predictable, sequential manner, but at different rates, are these stages: emergent, where they're identifying things logographically; phonic, which would be letter by letter; more sophisticated and more accurate is using analogies; more sophisticated and fluent would be syllabic, and then the most sophisticated with integrating meaning would be a morphemic analysis. And those stages are very sequential and predictable. They happen to children at different time periods, and that's what we need to be identifying, is where are the children along that sequence. Same thing with spelling. Same predictable sequence. And so we want to be able to identify where children are by using diagnostic assessments. The screening that you have used to determine that a child may be having difficulty in these areas would be either letter naming in the kindergarten, would be nonsense words, and phonemic decoding, any of which is in tower. The diagnostic assessment that you might want to use is, you would want to use, for children who are having difficulty with nonsense words, you would want to go to some kind of systematic phonics inventory that actually shows what patterns children have control over and don't have control over. You would want to use something like a Z-test that looks at the 37 common rhymes. Children can use those 37 common rhymes to identify 500 other words. So that would be a test that would be worthwhile for the second grader. And then also, you want to do a very close, you do not want to skip that error analysis in grades 1 and 2. When children are making miscues, you want to analyze those errors using that MSV analysis to identify what strategies do children use when they come to a word that is unknown. And they must have errors in their reading to identify that. So you need to be able to have a running record of text reading that's between 90 and 95% accuracy. If it's above 95%, you're not having enough errors to do the kind of analysis that's needed to see what processing children are using when they're coming upon trouble. The developmental spelling inventory, I swear I do not get any money from advocating for this book, but it is the dirtiest, quickest way that you can find out what problems your child is having and what parts of words they are noticing. It is it's a wonderful diagnostic tool, and I do advocate that schools use this, because it can be used. The administration is very simple. It's a simple spelling test, but the information that you get has so many implications diagnostically. So these are some of the tests that you will, that we do have available in reproducible form in that book. Now, the tower is a test that's normed, and I strongly recommend that particularly in grades 3, 4, and 5, this be used diagnostically because it is normed. And for those children who may have memorized words, like some of the more common high-frequency words, and you think you give them the Dolch list and they seem to be mastering it, you go, well, gee, when they have a low fluency score on your oral reading fluency from Dibbles or Ames-Webb, the two difficult areas, the two areas of difficulty are going to be either high-frequency words or decoding ability, or both. And so if you just give them the Dolch list, children in third grade and fourth grade may know those Dolch words. However, the tower is a wonderful tool that, and a school would have to buy this, that does identify what is the age equivalency of children who are reading this many words right per minute. And so I find it to be, for children in the upper grades, a wonderful diagnostic tool to be used by the Tier 2 and the Tier 3 teacher to gain additional information in the decoding and word recognition skills. It can't really be used diagnostically, though, again, because it's just a list of words and you don't want to teach those words. So for older children, I would then go to instruction of those fry words. Then progress monitoring using your intervention central and the, or, you know, some of the high frequency words available by Fuchs. But it does provide, the screening does provide you with information about whether children are having problems in that area, and I would be providing progress monitoring on that. Certainly, both the CBMs are the best gauge of oral reading fluency. However, you do have to keep in mind that, you know, for children, say, in third grade, if they are reading below level, that it is going to give you a score for their reading in which they are having trouble processing. So you still want to get a words correct per minute on by using a timed reading of an informal reading inventory or some other kind of reading kit that you might be using. You really must time those. So because the likelihood is, what we have found in our reading clinic here at NYU is that typically when children are reading at when they're having problems in fluency, even on that ORF at grade level, even when we have them reading at an instructional level in accuracy, typically their reading rate is lower than it needs to be based on the Hasbrouck and Tyndall norms or some other set of oral reading fluency norms. And so that does need attention. And you need to find out exactly where they are in relationship to that. And again, in order to raise reading fluency, the strategies, the, you know, once you've diagnosed that reading problems exist through multiple measures, both your CBM and the running record from an instructional level kit, you want to work on word recognition, using your diagnostic tools from word recognition, and you want to work on high-frequency words. There are also tools that you might use to for first graders to look at prosody, like the NAEP scale or the multidimensional fluency scale can be used to inform instruction. Now let's shift gears to what it's really all about. And that is those constrained skills of vocabulary and comprehension. What we've talked about, the phonics or decoding, fluency, phonological awareness, are all considered constrained abilities. They develop in a fairly linear pathway. And with instruction, children are going to develop mastery of those abilities within a few years. They reach a ceiling. Basically, those skills are either known or not known. They either know them, they either know the letter V and how it sounds and how to write it, or they don't. They either know the pattern ATE or they don't. Unlike unconstrained abilities, which involve comprehension and vocabulary, and these are multidimensional, they are grow incrementally. So, for example, a child can read a passage. I could read a medical journal, and I could certainly read it and get some idea of maybe what it was about, what illness it's about. But so I would have a little bit of knowledge of the passage, but I would certainly not be able to. I don't think you would trust me after me reading an article on bladder cancer. I don't think you would trust me to work on somebody with bladder cancer based on my knowledge of that article. And so comprehension in that way is incremental. And what we need are instruments and multiple assessments to really identify these dimensions of comprehension and vocabulary. And these skills also develop across a lifetime. So if we think back to our cognitive model, and now we are moving to that second, that middle pathway of the language comprehension, and that middle pathway in our model combines background knowledge, it combines and meeting vocabulary, and knowledge of structure, okay? How stories are structured, the structure of a narrative. It has a particular structure. Informational text has a different structure. These are all things that we also need to be able to assess and identify. Okay. There are ways that you might evaluate the many vocabulary measures that are on the market. This is not as easy to assess, and you'll want to use multiple measures. You will, you know, things that are discrete would be using a vocabulary program or selecting words and just giving children a single test that has them find definitions. That would be a discrete measure. Embedded would be for you to sit down with your students who are having a conversation about a text that they read or while they're doing a science experiment and using a check sheet that they are able to use those words embedded in their conversation. Selective and comprehensive relates to the corpus of words that are included on the test. So, for example, something like the Peabody vocabulary test, the corpus is the English language. It's very hard to budge that. No matter how great you are at teaching vocabulary in your classroom, that's going to be pretty hard to budge. However, you can make a list of words for your science unit or your social studies unit, and that would be far more selective, and that would be very easy to show how children are gaining across a unit. Decontextualized and contextualized assessments. Decontextualized means that a child can just identify that word without relying on the context. However, contextualized is something like the New York State ELA. Whenever the New York State ELA test, the new test will ask children a vocabulary word, those children will have to refer back to the passage to see how that word was used, because the word, all the vocabulary words they pick are context specific. You will need to be careful in screening measures. Again, some new measures, some new CBM measures are being researched currently. And, you know, I don't think any of those are on the market, but those are something you may want to be on the lookout for. They are related to primarily science and social studies words for fourth and fifth grade. However, there's no need to wait for that. Diagnostically, and this would be more of a classroom, one of those preliminary diagnoses, I doubt that a tier two or tier three teacher would be, you know, may want to reinforce this language. But this is something that diagnostically could be done in a classroom as a formative assessment. Making a list of words from your content units and then using assessments to assess those target vocabulary words that are part of a social studies unit or part of a science unit. And in fact, this is what the National Reading Panel has recommended. So, using some vocabulary knowledge rating scales for children to self-identify how much they know about various kinds of vocabulary, to identify a vocabulary recognition task where children would have to say whether they know the word, don't know the word, and then would have to categorize it. Is it, for example, is it a kind of animal body part? If you're talking, doing a unit on insects, is this animal body parts? Is this a home for insects? Is this a type of an insect? And then also doing those kinds of notes on conversations, that is a wonderful, wonderful formative and diagnostic assessment to actually have your list of a targeted vocabulary words, have the children's name, have them doing conversations that are content related, and then you are checking off their application and use of those words. For and also for the classrooms with English learners, we certainly want to employ cognate charts. Now, I do want to say a few words about the comprehension challenge of, one of the things. First, I'm going to talk about what is not diagnostic. One of the biggest things that we want to be mindful of is that the New York State ELA is not a diagnostic tool. It is a summative assessment, and this should not be necessarily used as the primary tool for grouping. It certainly is a screener, and it can give you the idea and give you the information about who is not able to demonstrate their performance on a certain standard. But the item analysis of the New York State ELA is not an effective use of school professional development time. And some of the research has demonstrated that children who are in non-proficient categories on state tests actually fall into 10 different clusters of ability. So we really want to make sure that we are employing diagnostic assessments before we put children into groups. We do not want to just put all the, oh, proficiency level one kids in this group, level two in that group, and certainly homerooms are not to be used as diagnostic groups. We want to move away from that. Well, I'm going to pick Miss Jones' kids up for tier three because they eat lunch at 11 o'clock and I have a period at 10, so I'm going to take all the her children at that time. In these upper grades, we must be doing some comprehension, more detailed formative comprehension tests that have good reliability and validity ratings. So we can use assessments of both informational and narrative passages. And they are more time consuming to administer, but we must, the diagnostics that we're looking for, we must get information about children's fluency. We can use that CBM as a starting point, but we must see how children are functioning fluency-wise on text at their instructional level as well. We need detailed information about their retellings. Just a rubric that says great retelling, moderate retelling, or unproficient does not cut it. That is not diagnostic. We need an analysis of idea units. We need an analysis of story grammar units, and these are only provided in your high quality, long-term, informal reading inventories that have a good history with good reliability and validity. Things such as the QRI, instruments such as the Johns Reading Inventory. The QRI by Leslie and Caldwell is really your gold standard for that, but it does take time to administer. And also questioning and answering ability. Again, we want questions. We want children to be asked questions that have been asked with large norming samples of children. And we want inferential questions and literal questions. Also, we want written responses to reading. children, especially on the ELA, are going to have to respond in writing. We can't see into children's heads, and that's where comprehension happens. We need to have oral artifacts by their oral responses on informal reading inventories, and then we need to see written responses, and we need to use our state rubric for teaching and testing. Now, for progress monitoring, I know that the webinar number 3 addressed this more thoroughly. You will be using your Ames Web or some other commercially produced maze measure, or perhaps the ORF as well, and using retelling rubrics. Also, I know in our reading clinic, we do use retelling rubrics that consider both idea units and story grammar elements with fidelity. We are very discriminate, and you'll need to be discriminate. This is very time consuming. And then also the written response units that children are writing compared with the New York State rubric. And so these are ways to ensure that our instruction is yielding improvement. Now I'm moving down to the third pathway of our cognitive model with cognitive strategies. We can find out these kinds of in-head processes. How are children thinking about reading? What strategies are they using? By using things like the Burke Reading Interview, which gets at children's perceptions about the purposes of reading. An Index of Reading Awareness, which actually gets children to apply certain strategies and talk about what strategies they typically use during reading. There's a textbook interview, which is fairly painless to administer, and it has narrative, a place for narratives and informational text. Probably one of the best one, and you would certainly want to reserve this for the children you're most worried about in Tier 3, are the Think Alouds. Those provide a wonderful window, have a very strong research base, but they do require expert administration. And you could use something like the QRI, which has a format in it that allows for the use of gauging strategy use through Think Alouds. And for those older children, we certainly have to be mindful of those affective factors. The best way to talk about things like motivation and attitude are through questionnaires and attitude surveys. For the uninterested child, we want to make sure that we are expanding student choices and using book series and that we're adding a social aspect. We cannot diagnostically ignore the affective factors in older children. It is just as real as the comprehension problems or decoding problems. And there are things that we can do to help them after, say, 3 to 4 years of struggling in reading. It's not any wonder that there are motivational issues. Let's identify them, face them head on through diagnostic techniques, and help them over that hurdle. In terms of actually looking at a diagnostic process, I want to just talk a little bit about what do we do with those children in grades 3, 4, and 5 who have scored in the areas of 1, who have proficiency ratings of 1 and 2. We need to provide differentiation, not by homeroom teacher, but by the children's need, the level of need, where that the area of need, and the degree of neediness. So you will be needing to use the triangulation of multiple measures. Certainly, you'll be starting with your ELA as a screen, as a red alert that this child needs some help. You'll then go to your CBM oral reading fluency. You'll use your Words Their Way elementary spelling inventory and some kind of informal reading inventory that includes retelling and questions. And you will identify, does the child who received a number one, a number two, is that child, are they having word recognition problems? What is their oral reading fluency? Is it in the caution or red area? If so, we need to put them in this track of intervention that is going to address those word recognition problems and also do more intense diagnostics on phonics and fluency. If the oral reading fluency is fine, then that problem and even the words that are away, spelling inventory identifies that child as being in the syllable affix stage or beyond, then that child is probably having purely comprehension problems. So they need a purely comprehension intervention and more diagnostics done in the area of comprehension. These two intervention pathways should be using different techniques and also doing different, more sophisticated diagnostic measures. So now I'm looking at the child who is having trouble with in the word recognition pathway and who needs some more word recognition help. In assessing for tier three, we would want to start with the high frequency words, give them the tower, give them the Fry word list. We would want to identify, are they having decoding problems? Informal phonics inventory can tell us exactly where that process is falling apart. The tower gives us a good view of whether this process is a process that he has the is age equivalent or whether that's a problematic area. Only if there are severe problems in this area would you then go down and do any kind of diagnostics in the phonemic awareness area. For children who are having trouble in the comprehension area and who scored in that one and two area, their proficiency was one or two. And now you're going to look at what is causing them to get a one or two in this comprehension? What kind of comprehension problems are they having? So you can identify vocabulary issues by looking at the Peabody picture vocabulary test or the expressive language test to identify if they're having vocabulary problems. You can use your informal reading inventory and really do an analysis of how they retell stories. Are they able to tell them in an order that adheres to that narrative structure? If they have no sense of narrative structure, a wonderful diagnostic tool is the Paris and Paris Research Tested Wordless Picture Book Assessment, which causes a child to have to identify a narrative structure, construct a whole narrative structure using just a picture book. And it is a wealth of information about that child who really has some difficulties retelling a story. Strategic knowledge, purposes for reading. Sometimes children think that the purpose of reading is to sound good. You know, if classrooms have maybe done some popcorn reading or round robin reading, children get the impression that a good reader sounds good. So these kinds of interviews can provide a lot of in-head insights into what a child thinks of the purpose of reading is. They may not really know that they're supposed to be comprehending. And then these two tests will give you insights about whether children are predicting, whether they're taking stock, whether they are monitoring their own reading and going back and rereading, and over what parts of a story, what are they doing when they get into trouble? When you and I are not understanding something we read, we have some strategies. We might reread, we might skip it. These diagnostic assessments will enable you to have a window into that child's mind and know what's happening when they're having difficulties comprehending. All of this leads to some very difficult conversations. For example, not everyone requires the same training. Classroom teachers don't need expertise on the same assessments that the special ed teacher or that the reading interventionist needs. So schools are going to really need to take a hard look at what assessments are we committed to, and how are we willing to show that commitment to those assessments by getting our teachers the training they need. The other challenge is transparency. We need to make sure that there are opportunities for true data sharing and planned data sharing for every single child in Tier 2 and Tier 3 that involves the classroom teacher, the literacy specialist, special education teachers, and others as periodic visitors, including the English language teacher. We really need to all make sure that this is done not just by handing the classroom teacher a score sheet or a notebook and saying, here is your kid's score, here are your kid's scores. This data really does need to be used to determine instructional status, and it will enable you to really see your children fly. As you can tell, I am in love with assessment and data because it has helped me as a teacher streamline my instruction. And I hope you'll fall in love with data too, in order to use it to help to know your students and to help you know yourself better and what you need to teach and how to streamline your own assessment and to make your life and the lives of your kids easier and more joyful. So I haven't seen any questions as we've gone along, so I hope that you'll feel free to ask some questions now. It was a lot of material, but let me know what you're thinking. Good. I'm glad to see some people are asking questions. I see some typing going on. Thank you. This is great. For me, this doesn't feel much like a conversation, so I'm glad to see you participating. I'm seeing that people are typing, so I want you to know I'm not answering any questions yet because I'm not seeing anything on my chat screen showing up in terms of completion. Okay. Oh my gosh, thank you, Celia. That is the most wonderful compliment. This is the first webinar I have ever done, so I appreciate you so much, Celia. Let's see. Could you please talk about the item analysis of New York State ELA versus something else like F&P? I would love to. That's a fabulous question. And I get so heartbroken when I go to schools and see schools doing this item analysis on the New York State ELA, because particularly back in the olden days with the old tests, what used to happen in test development for standardized tests is that test developers were given an assignment, and they would be given a passage and say, develop a main idea question for this, develop a sequence question for this. The new test on the Common Core, whether it's the New York State test or whether it is the new PARC test or the new Smarter Balance test that are being developed, are based on something called evidence-centered design. And all those websites will explain this to you probably a lot better and more thoroughly than I can in this time. But it's a new kind of test design that means that the items are built to work together. So one item is not just testing one standard. All the items are built. Otherwise, you would have to have a test that had 200 questions on it. So these items are all designed to be interrelated. So doing an item analysis does not really give you the information that one would logically think that it would provide for you. The other reason that item analysis does not work is because children who are having comprehension problems, comprehension is an unconstrained skill. If a kid can't do a main idea, he can't do character development either, because they are all that cognitive stew is dependent on so many threshold factors. And so therefore, what we logically would think, well, if I just pick out all these main idea questions and spend my time doing that, then I'm going to figure out the kids who don't know the main idea. Well, the reality is those kids who can't do main idea, there are a lot of other comprehension things that they can't do, and you are going to find a very high correlation between kids who can't do main idea and kids who can't identify the trajectory of a plot sequence or the trajectory of a character development across a story. And not one question is getting at those new standards. Now, for something like F&P, well, they don't really have questions in their test, so you can't really, that, you know, the S&P test, it only gives you prompts. And so if anything, I think that you're a lot better off looking at, I would rather compare it to something like the QRI, the Qualitative Reading Inventory, which has inferential questions and literal questions. And that's a good starting place. That's a very general good starting place. Is the kid who's answering the inferential questions, sometimes a kid can answer inferential questions and can't answer literal questions because he's making it up as he goes along based on high level of prior knowledge. So if a child has a lot of prior knowledge, they may be doing a less good job at attending to the text-based information. And as a teacher who's teaching in Tier 2 or Tier 3, you'd better know that. Then other children may have trouble with the inference process, children who may not have lots of prior knowledge, children who may not have a large background of experience. And so these are the kinds of analyses that you want to engage in with an informal reading inventory like the qualitative reading inventory. Now, F&P, I find that to be more problematic. I think that F&P works very well in kindergarten, first and second grade when you're not getting into, or not even in mid-second grade. Kindergarten and first grade when you're looking for a gradient of text, but there are not enough, there has not been enough research analysis of the quest of a question, set of questions on the F&P test that have good questions that have been normed over time using a large sample of children. And so I would feel more comfortable as a teacher and as a diagnostician using something like the QRI. Okay, I hope that answered your question, Celia. What do you recommend in terms of progress monitoring regarding early childhood? Well, I think we need to use those foundational skills. I mean, I think that the progress monitoring tools that are recommended in terms of for kindergarten, letter ID, beginning, and then beginning letter segmentation, the segmentation so that you can see as a screener where children are falling, whether they are proficient or not, to then do as a signal to do your diagnostics. I would add as progress monitoring, I don't know why Dibbles and AIMSWeb don't use it. In the clinic, I also use high frequency words, and I get my students to use the Intervention Central and to make their own progress monitoring tasks for first graders using for high frequency words, because the research does show that in first grade those high frequency words are important. Certainly mid first grade, I'm really looking very closely at the Dibbles and AIMSWeb progress monitoring. I want my children to be able to do nonsense words. I want them to be able to be meeting those oral reading fluency proficiency ratings, because those are general outcome measures of what my children need in terms of foundational skills. Oh, Kelly, what a hard question. What are some recommendations do you have for looking at students in high school? That is a really tough question. My best advice when we have children, I guess I shouldn't be calling them children, when I have students from high school in the clinic, and I do have several secondary people in the clinic, here is what we do. I tell my folks at high school, you can't solve this child has lots of problems. We are not going to be able to solve all this student's problems in 24 clip hours of, 24 1-hour sessions. And so my best advice to most high school teachers who are in an intervention setting, would be to pick a couple targets and work on those targets and progress monitor those targets. Because I don't really believe in using those programs for tier three kids. And so therefore, I would be using some research-based practices like SQ3R and some other practices that have been used. I would be focusing on motivation and comprehension for the most part. And if they need that fluency threshold, I would start with ORF. Do they need their fluency threshold lifted? If so, I would be spending a portion of the time building fluency. I would have a 10-minute part of the time with some kind of decoding or vocabulary morphology kind of skill with like morphemes or syllables, depending on where they are developmentally. That would be 10 minutes. And then I would be spending probably 40 minutes on building a particular aspect of comprehension, whether it's structure and getting them to be able to n identify the structure of a narrative and be able to retell that and write it. Or then I would pick another text structure, some other kind of informational structure, and do that. That would be for the most severe students. Other students who are not as severe, I might work with the classroom teachers and make sure that I am doing some disciplinary work that is also in alignment with what the children are demanded to do in their classroom. So, for example, let's say in history they are working on a particular historical period and those children are having to write either explanatory or argumentative essays. Then I would be working on getting those children to read perhaps shorter information in my intervention setting. I would get them to read that inter that a shorter piece of text, around their instructional level or a little above as a stretch text. And then I would be doing some instruction in I would actually be doing some instruction in the how to write to reflect that. And I would be using their idea units. I would be looking at increasing their idea units and using the state rubrics to make sure that the content of those written responses to text are containing more and more of those meaty units, of those meaty elements that are demanded on those rubrics. And I would be getting the children to self-evaluate themselves at the middle and high school level using those rubrics as well. I am not familiar. I'm going down to the next question. Are you familiar with Success Maker from Pearson? If so, how would you use the program as a form of intervention? I am not familiar with Success Maker, I'm sorry to say. However, I will tell you that my personal position is that the teacher needs to, if we have children in intervention, whatever intervention program you're using in tier two, you'd better be darned sure that it matches your diagnostic assessments that you have done separate from any kind of program. That program has to be held to your diagnostic standards. And the fidelity is checked by your progress monitoring that is exclusive from the program. Because if the kid is not making progress on those things that we're wanting progress monitoring to measure, then I'm not sure, you know, the program is always a tool to meet our diagnostic goals. So that would be my answer. And I don't really believe very much in using diagnostic programs in either tier 3 or special education. Because I do believe that children who have reached that level of need, we've got to be very careful, because programs typically have not worked with that child. And if we really want to hit that sweet spot for those very special children, we really had better be making sure that our program, our intervention is tightly matched to their diagnosis. So now I'm looking at Brianne. I face a challenge working with middle school students that are 4 to 5 grade levels below the grade level. Okay, without insulting students, which program of recommendation? I think for those middle school students, again, you have to really just find out when I think that when you're working with older students, if they're in middle school and they're 4 to 5 grade levels below grade level, then you have a clear diagnostic target, you know, that you know exactly what word study. Are they still needing to learn long vowels? If that's what they need, Brianne, then that's what we teach. And it doesn't matter if they're in first grade or fifth grade or 11th grade or eighth grade. So if your diagnostic, using your words their way, identified that they are unable to display an awareness of how to write long vowels, then that's what I'm going to teach for a small portion of my intervention period. Those children would probably also, if you have your assessments, you also know exactly where their oral reading fluency is and where they are falling in terms of competence. And so I suspect most of your middle schoolers need fluency help. So I would be doing at least 10 minutes of every intervention period working using some kind of fluency techniques, including charted individual repeated reading, and then including paired reading, write this down, paired reading by Keith Topping. That is a research-based technique for improving fluency and comprehension for middle schoolers, and I would definitely use that for the children that you're talking about. And then you can't ignore the comprehension at that grade level, even if they have decoding problems. The guideline in my reading clinic here is that we only do 50% isolated skills, and the other 50% must be connected text reading, because comprehension is always our main goal. Okay, I hope that answered your question, Brianne. Good luck to you. Good luck. You folks in middle school and high school, I'm so glad you're here today, because you really have the toughest challenge, I believe. Let's see. Thoughts on developmental assessment tools to be used in conjunction with diagnostic tools. I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I guess I consider myself a developmental. I believe in doing things developmentally. So I think that the diagnostic tools that I shared with you today tend to take a very developmental approach. I hope that answers your question, but I think that they are developmentally appropriate. So I've reached the end of the, I don't know whether Teresa is here or Teresa, are you here? You all, thank you all so much for your questions. I really felt like I was by myself here, so it was so wonderful to see you pop up with those great questions and to see your names. And I will be looking for every one of you when we do the next webinar series, in which I'll be talking about the Common Core and RTI and differentiating instruction. So thank you so much for your time and attention this late in the day.
Dr. Stahl, this is Molly. Thank you so much again for today, and we do look forward to connecting again in
February.
And everyone, if you just we'll take a few minutes to do the survey. I did post the link earlier, and you'll get an email reminder with the link. So if you would give us some feedback, we do appreciate that. It looks like folks are signing off. So have a great night, everybody.
Okay, thank you. So I should just hang up?
Hang on a second. I'll put you in
okay.
The conference.